What are you? Pole? Russian? What? The young man opened his eyes and took a long breath before speaking.
I am an investigative reporter for the Berliner Tageblatt.
They hit him again with the electric cord, and this time he passed out. Bach watched a man's back approach the victim and check his eyes and pulse. The torturer appeared to be wearing a chemical warfare protective suit of rubberized fabric, but without the hood and gloves. It must have been awfully hot, Bach thought. Obviously, a trained intelligence officer. Probably Russian. Not circumcised, and his dental work is stainless steel, not especially well done. That means an East Block service, of course. Too bad. This lad is quite brave. The voice was admirably clinical, Bach thought. What drugs do we have? Another voice asked. A rather good tranquilizer. Now? Now. Not too much. Very well. The man went off camera, then returned with a syringe. He grasped the victim's upper arm, then injected the drug into a vein inside the elbow. It took 3 minutes before the KGB man regained consciousness, just enough for the rush of drugs to assault his higher brain functions.
Sorry if we had to do that to you.
You have passed the test, the voice said, this time in Russian.
What test?
The answer was in Russian, just 2 words before his brain took hold and stopped him.
Why did you ask me in Russian?
Because that was what we wished to know.
Good night.
The victim's eyes went wide as a small caliber pistol appeared, was placed against his chest, and fired. The camera withdrew a bit to show more of the room. A plastic sheet, actually 3 of them, covered the floor to catch blood and other droppings under the metal chair. The bullet wound was speckled with black powder marks and bulged outward from the intrusion of gun gases below the skin. There wasn't much bleeding. Heart wounds never produced much. In a few more seconds, the body stopped quivering.
It could have taken more time to ascertain additional information, but we have what we need, as I will explain later.
It was Keitel's voice, off camera.
Now, Traudl.
They brought her in front of the camera, hands bound in front of her, her mouth gagged with the same bandaging tape, her eyes wide in terror, naked. She was trying to say something around the gag, but no one there had been interested. The tape was a day and a half old, of course. Gunther could tell that from the TV that was playing in the corner, tuned to an evening news broadcast. The entire performance was a professional tour de force designed to meet his requirements. Bach could almost hear the man thinking, "Now, how do we do this?" Gunther momentarily regretted the instructions he'd given Keitel. But the evidence had to be positive. Magicians and other experts in illusion regularly consulted with intelligence agencies. But some things could not be faked, and he had to be sure that he could trust Keitel to do terrible and dangerous things. It was an objective necessity that this be graphic. Another man looped a rope over a ceiling beam and hauled her hands up. Then the first pressed his pistol into her armpit and fired a single shot. At least he wasn't a sadist, Bach thought. Such people were not reliable. It was quite sad to watch, in any case. The bullet had punctured her heart, but she was too excited to die quickly, struggling for more than half a minute, eyes still wide, fighting for breath, still trying to speak, probably begging for help, asking why. After she went limp, one checked the pulse at her neck, then lowered her slowly to the floor. They'd been as gentle about it as they could have been under the circumstances. The shooter spoke without facing the camera.
I hope you are satisfied. I did not enjoy this.
You weren't supposed to, Bach said to the television set. The Russian was taken off the chair and laid beside Traudl from. While the bodies were dismembered, Keitel's voice spoke. It was a useful diversion, as the visual scene simply got more horrible. Bach was not squeamish about many things, but it troubled his psyche when human bodies were abused after death. Necessary or not, it seemed gratuitous to him. The Russian is undoubtedly an intelligence officer, as you have seen. His automobile was a rental from Berlin and is being driven tomorrow to Magdeburg, where it will be turned in. It was parked down the street. Normal procedure for a professional, of course, but a giveaway in the event of capture. In the car we found a list of names, all of them in the DDR nuclear power industry. It would seem that our Russian comrades have suddenly become interested in Honecker's bomb project. A pity we didn't have another few years to follow up on that, no? I regret the complication involved, but it took us several days to set up arrangements for disposing of the bodies, and we had no idea Frau Fromm had her guest when we knocked on the door. At that point, of course, it was too late. Besides, with the rain, we had ideal conditions for the kidnapping. Two men were working on each body. All wore the protective suits, and now they had their hoods and masks on, doubtless to protect them from the smell as much as to protect their identity. As in a slaughterhouse, sawdust was applied in buckets full to soak up the copious amounts of blood being spilled. Bach knew from experience just how messy murders could be. They worked quickly as Keitel's voiceover went on, using powered industrial cutting tools. Arms and legs had been removed from the torsos, and then the heads were removed and held up to the camera. No one could fake this. Keitel's men had truly murdered two human beings. The dismemberment in front of a playing television made that absolutely certain, and would doubtless also make disposal easier. The pieces were assembled neatly for wrapping in plastic. One of the men started brushing the blood-soaked sawdust into a pile for yet another plastic bag. The body parts will be burned at two widely separated locations. This will be accomplished long before you get the tape. That ends our message. We await further instructions. And the tape returned to the dramatization of the 1920 Olympics. Or was it 1924, Bach wondered. Not that it mattered, of course.
Yes, Colonel. One of my officers has failed to check in.
The Colonel was from Directorate T, the technical branch of the first Chief Directorate. The holder of a doctor's degree in engineering, his personal specialty was missile systems. He had worked in America and France, ferreting out the secrets of various military weapons before being promoted to his current job.
Details? Captain Yevgeny Stepanovich Feodorov, age 30. Married, one child, a fine young officer on the major's list. He was one of the three I sent into Germany at your direction to check out their nuclear facilities. He's one of my best.
How long? Golovko asked.
6 days. He flew into Berlin via Paris last week. He had German papers, good ones from downstairs, and a list of 10 names to investigate. His instructions were to maintain a low profile unless he discovered something important, in which case he was to make contact with Station Berlin. What's left of it, I mean. We scheduled a periodic check-in, of course. He didn't make it, and after 24 hours, I got the alert.
Could it be that he's just careless?
Not this boy, the Colonel said flatly. Does the name mean anything to you?
Feodorov.
Wasn't his father Stefan Yurievich, yes. Yevgeny is his youngest son.
Good God.
Stefan taught me, Golovko said.
Possibility of defection? The Colonel shook his head angrily.
Not a chance. His wife is in the chorus with the opera. No. They met in university and married young over the objections of both sets of parents. It's a love match like we all wish we had. She's a stunningly beautiful girl, voice like an angel. Only a Zhopnik would walk away from her. Then there's the child. He is, by all reports, a good father.
Golovko saw where this was leading.
Arrested, then? I haven't heard a whisper. Perhaps you might arrange to have that checked. I fear the worst.
The colonel frowned and stared down at the rock. He didn't want to be the one who broke the news to Natalia Feodorova.
Hard to believe, Golovkov said.
Sergei Nikolaevich, if your suspicions are correct, then this program we were tasked to investigate is a matter of grave importance to them, is it not? We may have confirmed something in the most expensive way possible.
General Lieutenant Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko was silent for several seconds.
It's not supposed to be like this, he told himself. The intelligence business is supposed to be civilized. Killing each other's officers is a thing of the distant past. We don't do that sort of thing anymore. Haven't done it in years. Decades.
None of the alternatives are credible, are they?
The colonel shook his head.
No. But the most credible is that our man stumbled into something both real and extremely sensitive. Sensitive enough to kill for. A secret nuclear weapons program, is that sensitive, is it not?
Arguably, yes.
The colonel was showing the sort of loyalty to his people that KGB expected, Golovko noted. He was also thinking over the alternatives and presenting his best estimate of the situation.
Have you sent your technical people to Sarova yet?
Day after tomorrow. My best man was sick, just got out of the hospital, broke his leg in a fall down some stairs.
Have him carried there, if necessary. I want a worst-case estimate of plutonium production at the DDR power stations. Send another man to Kushtym to back-check the people at Sarova. Pull in the other people you sent to Germany. We'll restart the investigation more carefully. Two-man teams, and the backup man is to be armed.
That is dangerous, Golovko said on reflection.
General, it takes a lot of time and money to train my field people. I will need 2 years to replace Feodorov. 2 whole years. You can't just pull an officer out of another branch and drop him into this line of work. These people must understand what they are looking for. Assets like that should be protected.
You are correct.
I will clear it with the chairman and send experienced officers. Maybe some people from the academy. Credential them like German police officials.
I like that, Sergei Nikolaevich.
Good man, Pavel Ivanich.
And on Feodorov.
Maybe he'll turn up. 30 days before he's declared missing, then I'll have to see his wife.
Very well.
I'll pull my people in and start planning the next phase of the operation. When will I have a list of the escort officers?
Tomorrow morning.
Very well, General. Thank you for your time.
Golovko shook the man's hand and remained standing until the door closed. He had 10 minutes until his next appointment.
Damn, he said to his desktop.
More delays. Fromm did not quite manage to hide his disgust.
We are saving time. The material we will be working on has machining characteristics similar to stainless steel. We must also manufacture blanks for the casting process. Here,
Fromm unfolded his working drawings.
We have here a folded cylinder of plutonium. Around the plutonium is a cylinder of beryllium, which is a godsend for our purposes. It is very light, very stiff, an X-ray window, and a neutron reflector. Unfortunately, it is also rather difficult to machine. We must use cubic boron nitride tools, essentially an analog to industrial diamond. Steel or carbon tools would have results you do not wish to contemplate. We also have health considerations.
Beryllium is not toxic, Gone said. I checked.
True, but the dust resulting from the matching process converts to beryllium oxide, which when inspired converts again to beryllium hydroxide, and that causes berylliosis, which is uniformly fatal.
Fromm paused, staring at Gone like a schoolmaster before going on.
Now,
Around the beryllium is a cylinder of tungsten rhenium, which we need for its density. We will purchase 12 kilograms in powder form, which we will sinter into cylindrical segments. You know sintering? That is heating it just hot enough to form. Melting and casting is too difficult and not necessary for our purposes. Around that goes the explosive lens assembly. And this is just the primary gun, not even a quarter of our total energy budget.
And the precision required?
Exactly. Think of this as the world's largest ring or necklace. What we produce must be as finely finished as the most beautiful piece of jewelry you have ever seen. Or perhaps a precision optical instrument.
The tungsten rhenium?
Available from any major electrical concern. It's used in special filaments for vacuum tubes, numerous other applications, and it's far easier to work than pure tungsten.
Beryllium?
Oh yes, it's used in gyroscopes and other instruments. 30 kilograms.
25.
Yes, get 30. You have no idea how lucky we are.
How so?
The Israeli plutonium is gallium stabilized. Plutonium has 4 phase transformations below melting point and has the curious habit, in certain temperature regimes, of changing its density by a factor of over 20%. It is a multi-state metal.
In other words, a subcritical mass can...
Exactly, Fromm said. What appears to be a subcritical mass can, under certain circumstances, convert itself into criticality. It will not explode, but the gamma and neutron flux would be lethal within a radius of, anywhere from 10 to 30 meters, depending on circumstances. That was discovered during the Manhattan Project. They were, not lucky. They were brilliant scientists, and as soon as they had a gram or so of plutonium, it was decided to investigate its properties. Had they waited, or simply assumed that they knew more than they did, well...
I had no idea, Gone admitted. Merciful God.
Not everything is in books, my young friend. Or should I say, not all the books have all the information. In any case, with the addition of gallium, the plutonium is a stable mass. It is actually quite safe to work, as long as we take the proper precautions.
So we start by machining out stainless steel blanks to these specifications, then make our casting molds.
Investment casting, of course.
Fromm nodded.
Correct. Very good, mein Junge.
Then, when the casting is done, we will machine the bomb material.
I see.
Well, we seem to have good machinists.
They'd drafted, that was the term they used, 10 men, all Palestinians, from local optical shops, and trained them on the use of the machine tools. The tools were all that Fromm had said they were. 2 years earlier, they'd been totally state-of-the-art, identical to the equipment used in the American Y-12 fabrication plant at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Tolerances were measured by laser interferometry, and the rotating tool heads were computer-controlled in 3 dimensions through 5 axes of movement. Instructions were passed to the computers via touchscreens. The design itself had been done on a mini-computer and drawn out on an expensive drafting machine. Gone and Fromm brought the machinists in and set them to work on their first task, making the stainless steel blank for the plutonium primary that would ignite the thermonuclear fire.
Now, Fromm said, for the explosive lenses.
I've heard much about you, Bach said.
I hope it was good, Marvin Russell replied with a guarded smile.
My first Indian, Bach thought quickly. He was oddly disappointed. Except for the cheekbones, he might have easily been mistaken for any Caucasian, and even those could seem like a Slav with perhaps a taste of Tatar in his background. What color there was had come mainly from the sun. The rest of the man was formidable enough, the size and obvious strength.
I hear you killed a police officer in Greece by snapping his neck.
I don't know why people make a big deal about that, Russell said with weary honesty. He was a scrawny little fuck, and I know how to take care of myself.
Bach smiled and nodded. I understand how you feel, but your method was impressive in any case. I have heard good things about you, Mr. Russell, and just call me Marvin. Everybody else does.
Bach smiled.
As you wish, Marvin. I am Gunther. Particularly your skill with weapons.
It's no big deal, Russell said, genuinely puzzled. Anybody can learn to shoot.
How do you like it here?
I like it a lot. These people. I mean, they have heart, you know? They ain't quitters. They work real hard at what they do. I admire that. And what they done for me, Gunther. It's like family, man. We are a family, Marvin. We share everything, good and bad. We all have the same enemies.
Yeah, I seen that.
We may need your help for something, Marvin. It's for something fairly important.
Okay, Russell replied simply.
What do you mean?
I mean, yes, Gunther.
You haven't even asked what it is, the German pointed out.
Okay.
Marvin smiled.
So tell me.
We need you to go back to America in a few months. How dangerous is that for you?
Depends. I've done time. In prison, I mean. You know that. My fingerprints are on file with the cops, but they don't have a picture of me. I mean, the one they have is pretty old. I've changed since then. They're looking for me up in the Dakotas, probably. If you send me there, it might be a little tricky.
Nowhere near there, Marvin.
Then it shouldn't be much of a problem, depending on what you need me to do.
How do you feel about killing people?
Americans, I mean.
Bach watched his face for a reaction.
Americans.
Marvin snorted.
Hey, man. I'm a fucking American, okay? My country ain't what you think. They stole my country from me, just like what happened to these guys here, okay? It ain't just here shit like that happened, okay? You want me to do some people for you? Yeah, I can do that, if you got a reason. I mean, I don't kill for fun. I ain't no psycho. But you got a reason. Sure, I can do it.
Maybe more than one. I heard you when you said people, Gunther. I ain't so stupid that I think people means one guy. You just make sure some cops, maybe even some FBI guys are in there. Yeah, I'll help kill all you want.
One thing you need to know, though.
What's that?
The other side ain't dumb. They got my brother, remember? They're serious dudes.
We also are serious, Bach assured him.
I seen that, man. What can you tell me about the job?
What do you mean, Marvin? Bach asked as casually as he could.
I mean I grew up there, man, remember? I know stuff that maybe you don't.
Okay, you got security and all that, and you ain't gonna tell me anything now.
Fine, that's no problem. But you might need my help later on. These guys here are okay. They're smart and all, but they don't know dick about America. I mean, not what you need to get around and stuff. You go hunting, you gotta know the ground. I know the ground.
That is why we want your help, Bach assured him, as though he'd already thought that part all the way through.
Actually, he had not. And now he was wondering just how useful this man might be.
Andrei Ilyich Narmanov saw himself as the captain of the world's largest ship of state. That was the good news. The bad news was that the ship had a leaky bottom, a broken rudder, and uncertain engines. Not to mention a mutinous crew. His office in the Kremlin was large, with room to pace about, something he found himself doing all too much of late. That, he thought, was a sign of an uncertain man, and the President of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics could not afford that, especially when he had an important guest. Union of Sovereign Soviet Republics, he thought. Though the official name change had not yet been approved, that was how his people were starting to think.
That's the problem.
The ship of state was breaking up. There was no precedent for it. The dissolution of the British Empire was the example that many liked to use, but that wasn't quite right, was it? Nor was any other example. The Soviet Union of old had been a unique political creation. What was now happening in the Soviet Union was also entirely without precedent. What had once been exhilarating to him was now more than frightening. He was the one who had to make the hard decisions, and he had no historical model to follow. He was completely on his own, as alone as any man had ever been, with a task larger than any man had ever faced. Lauded in the West as a consummate political tactician, he thought of it himself as an endless succession of crises.
Wasn't it Gladstone, he thought? Wasn't it he who described his job as being the man on a raft in the rapids, fending off rocks with a pole? How apt. How apt, indeed.
Narmanov and his country were being swept along by overwhelming forces of history. Somewhere down that river was an immense cataract, a falls that could destroy everything. But he was too busy with the pole and the rocks to look so far ahead. That was what being a political tactician meant. He devoted all his creative energy to day-to-day survival and was losing sight of the next week, even the day after tomorrow.
Andrei Ilyich, you are growing thin, Oleg Kirillovich Kadyshev observed from his leather seat.
The walking is good for my heart, the president replied wryly.
Then perhaps you will join our Olympic team.
Narmanov stopped for a moment.
It would be nice indeed to compete merely against foreigners. They think I am brilliant. Alas, our own people know better.
What can I do to help, my president?
I need your help, the help of those on the right.
It was Kadyshev's turn to smile. The press, Western as well as Soviet, never got that straight. The left wing in the Soviet Union was that of the communist hardliners. For over 80 years, reform in that country had always come from the right. All the men executed by Stalin for wanting to allow the merest bit of personal freedom had always been denounced as right deviationists. But self-styled progressives in the West were always on the political left, and they called their reactionary enemies conservatives and generally identified them as being on the political right. It seemed too great a stretch of imagination for Western journalists to adjust their ideological polarity to a different political reality. The newly liberated Soviet journalists had merely aped their Western colleagues and used the foreign descriptions to muddle what was already a chaotic political scene. The same was true of progressive Western politicians, of course, who were championing so many of the experiments of the Soviet Union in their own countries. All the experiments which had been taken to the limit and proven to be something worse than mere failures. Perhaps the blackest humor available in all the world was the carping from leftist elements in the West, some of whom were already observing that the backward Russians had failed because they had proven unable to convert socialism into a humanistic government, whereas advanced Western governments could accomplish just that. Of course, Karl Marx himself had said that, hadn't he? Such people were, Kadyshev thought with a bemused shake of his head, no less idealistic than the members of the first revolutionary Soviets, and just as addle-brained. The Russians had merely taken the revolutionary ideals to their logical limits and found there only emptiness and disaster. Now that they were turning back, a move that called for political and moral courage such as the world had rarely seen, the West still didn't understand what was happening.
Khrushchev was right all along,
the parliamentarian thought. Politicians are the same all over the world. Mostly idiots.
Andrei Ilyich, we do not always agree on methods, but we have always agreed on goals. I know you are having trouble with our friends on the other side.
And with your side, President Narmanov pointed out more sharply than he should have.
And with my side, it is true, Kadyshev admitted casually.
Andrei Ilyich, do you say that we must agree with you on everything? Narmanov turned, his eyes momentarily angry and wide.
Please, not that, not today.
How may we help you?
Losing control of your emotions, comrade president. A bad sign, my friend.
I need your support on the ethnic issue. We cannot have the entire union break apart.
Kadyshev shook his head forcefully.
That is inevitable. Letting the Balts and the Azeris go eliminates many problems. We need the Azerbaijani oil. If we let that go, our economic situation worsens. If we let the Balts go, the momentum will strip away half of our country.
Half our population, true, but scarcely 20% of our land.
And most of our problems, Kadyshev said again. And what of the people who live? We throw them into chaos and civil war. How many will die? How many deaths on our conscience, huh? The president demanded.
Which is a normal consequence of decolonization. We cannot prevent it. By attempting to, we merely keep the civil war within our own borders. That forces us to place too much power into the hands of the security forces, and that is too dangerous. I don't trust the army any more than you do.
The army will not launch a coup. There are no Bonapartists in the Red Army.
You have greater confidence in their fealty than I do. I think they see a unique historical opportunity. The party has held the military down since the Tukhachevsky business. Soldiers have long memories, and they may be thinking that this is their chance.
Those people are all dead, and their children with them,
Narmanov countered angrily. It had been over 50 years, after all. Those few with direct memory of the purges were in wheelchairs or living on pensions.
But not their grandchildren, and there is institutional memory to consider as well.
Kadyshev leaned back and considered a new thought that had sprung almost fully formed into his head.
Might that be possible?
They have concerns, yes, and those concerns are little different from my own. We differ on how to deal with the problem, not on the issue of control. While I am not sure of their judgment, I am sure of their loyalty.
Perhaps you are correct, but I am not so sanguine.
With your help, we can present a united front to the forces of early dissolution. That will discourage them. That will allow us to get through a few years of normalization, and then we can consider an orderly departure for the republics with a genuine commonwealth. Association, whatever you wish to call it, to keep us associated economically while being separate politically.
The man is desperate, Kadyshev saw. He really is collapsing under the strain. The man who moves about the political arena like a Central Army hockey forward is showing signs of fatigue.
Will he survive without my help?
Probably, Kadyshev judged. Probably. That was too bad, the younger man thought. Kadyshev was the de facto leader of the forces on the left, the forces that wanted to break up the entire country and the government that went with it, yanking the remaining nation, based on the Russian Federation, into the 21st century by its throat. If Narmanov fell, if he found himself unable to continue, then who?
Why, me, of course.
Would the Americans support him?
How could they fail to support Agent Spinnaker of their own Central Intelligence Agency?
Kadyshev had been working for the Americans since his recruitment by Mary Patricia Foley some 6 years before. He didn't think of it as treason. He was working for the betterment of his country and saw himself as succeeding. He'd fed the Americans information on the internal workings of the Soviet government, some of it highly valuable, some material they could as easily have gotten from their own reporters. He knew that they regarded him as their most valuable source of political intelligence in the Soviet Union, especially now that he controlled fully 40% of the votes in the country's bumptious new parliament, the Congress of People's Deputies. 39%, he told himself. One must be honest. Perhaps another 8% could be his if he made the proper move. There were many shades of political loyalty among the 2,500 members. Genuine Democrats, Russian nationalists of both Democratic and Socialist stripe, radicals of both left and right. There was also a cautious middle of politicians, some genuinely concerned about what course their country might take, others merely seeking to conserve their personal political status. How many could he appeal to? How many could he win over? Not quite enough. But there was one more card he could play, wasn't there? Da. If he had the audacity to play it. Andrei Ilyich, he said in a conciliatory voice, you ask me to depart from an important principle so that I can help you reach a goal we share, but to do so by a route that I distrust. This is a very difficult matter. I am not even sure that I can deliver the support you require. My comrades might well turn their backs on me. It only agitated the man further. Rubbish. I know how well they trust you and your judgment. They are not the only ones who trust me, Kadyshev told himself. As with most investigations, this one was done mainly with paper. Ernest Wellington was a young attorney, and an ambitious one. As a law school graduate and a member of the bar, he could have applied to the FBI and learned the business of investigation properly, but he considered himself a lawyer rather than a cop, besides which he enjoyed politics, and the FBI prided itself on avoiding political wrangling wherever possible. Wellington had no such inhibitions. He enjoyed politics, considered it the life's blood of government service, and knew it to be the path to speedy advancement both within and without the government. The contacts he was making now would make his value to any of 100 connected law firms jump fivefold, plus making him a known name within the Department of Justice. Soon he would be in the running for a special assistant job. After that, in 5 years or so, he'd have a crack at a section chief's office, maybe even U.S. attorney in a major city, or head of a special DOJ strike force. That opened the door to political life, where Ernest Wellington could be a real player in the great game of Washington. All in all, it was heady wine indeed for an ambitious man of 27 years, an honors graduate from Harvard Law who'd ostentatiously turned down lucrative offers from prestigious firms, preferring instead to devote his early professional years to public service. Wellington had a pile of paper on his desk. His office was in what was almost an attic in the Justice Department's building on the Mall, and the view from the single window was of the parking lot that rested in the center of the Depression-era structure. It was small, and the air conditioning was faulty, but it was private. It is little appreciated that lawyers avoid time in court as assiduously as the boastful avoid genuine tests of ability. Had he taken the jobs offered by the New York corporate firms, the best such offer was for over $100,000 per year, his real function would have been that of proofreader, really a glorified secretary, examining contracts for typos and possible loopholes. Early life in the Justice Department was little different. Whereas in a real prosecutorial office, he might have been tossed alive into a courtroom environment to sink or swim, here at headquarters he examined records, looking for inconsistencies, nuances, possible technical violations of the law, as though he were an editor for a particularly good mystery writer. Wellington started making his notes. John Patrick Ryan, deputy to the Director of Central Intelligence, nominated by the President. Politics at work, and confirmed less than 2 years previously. Prior to that, acting Deputy Director, Intelligence, following the death of Vice Admiral James Greer. Prior to that, Special Assistant to DDI Greer, and sometime Special Representative of the Directorate of Intelligence over in England. Ryan had been an instructor in history at the Naval Academy, a graduate student at Georgetown University, and a broker at the Baltimore office of Merrill Lynch. Also briefly, a second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. Clearly a man who enjoyed career changes, Wellington thought, noting all the important dates. Personal wealth. The requisite financial statement was in the file near the top. Ryan was worth quite a bit. Where had it come from? That analysis took several hours. In his days as a broker, J.P. Ryan had been a real cowboy. He'd bet over $100,000 on the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad at the time of the employee takeover and reaped over $6 million from it. That was his one really big score. 60-to-1 opportunities were not all that common, were they? But some of the others were also noteworthy. On hitting a personal net worth of $8 million, he'd called it quits and gone to Georgetown for his doctorate in history. Continued to play the market on an amateur basis. That wasn't quite right, was it? Until joining government service. His portfolio was now managed by a multiplicity of investment counselors. Their accounting methods were unusually conservative. Ryan's net worth looked to be $20 million, maybe a little more. The accounts were managed on a blind basis. All Ryan saw was quarterly earnings statements. There were ways around that, of course, but it was all strictly legal. Proving impropriety was virtually impossible unless they put a wiretap on the line of his brokers, and that was not something easily accomplished. He had been investigated by the SEC, but that had actually been a spin-off of the SEC's look at the firm he'd bought into. The summary sheet noted in clipped bureaucratese that no technical violation had been made. But Wellington observed that this judgment was more technical than substantive. Ryan had balked at signing a consent order, understandably, and the government had not pressed him on the issue. That was less understandable, but explainable, since Ryan had not been the actual target of the investigation. Someone had decided that it had all probably been a coincidence. Ryan had, however, broken that money out of his main account. Gentleman's agreement, Wellington wrote on his legal pad. Perhaps. If asked, Ryan would respond that he'd done it out of an over-scrupulous sense of guilt. The money had gone into T-bills, rolled over automatically for years, and untouched until it had all been used to... I see. That's interesting. Why an educational trust fund? Who was Carol Zimmer? What interest did Ryan have in her children? Timing? Significance? It was amazing, as always, that so much paper could show so little. Perhaps, Wellington mused, that was the real point of government paperwork, to give the appearance of substance while saying as little as possible. He chuckled. That was also the point of most legal papers, wasn't it? For $200 per hour, lawyers loved to quibble over the placement of commas and other weighty matters. He paused, recycling his brain. He had missed something very obvious. Ryan was not liked by the Fowler administration. Why, then, had he been nominated for DDCI? Politics? But politics was the reason you selected people unqualified for... Did Ryan have any political connections at all? The file didn't show any. Wellington riffled through the papers and found a letter signed by Alan Trent and Sam Fellows of the House Select Committee. That was an odd couple, a gay and a Mormon. Ryan had sailed through confirmation much more easily than Marcus Cabot, even easier than Bunker and Talbot, the president's two-star cabinet members. Part of that was because he was a second-level man, but that didn't explain it all. That meant political connections, and very fine ones. Why? What connections? Trent and Fellows? What the hell could those two ever agree on? It was certain that Fowler and his people didn't like Ryan, else the Attorney General would not have personally placed Wellington on the case. Case? Was that the right term for his activities? If there was a case, why wasn't this being handled by the FBI? Politics, obviously. Ryan had worked closely with the FBI on several things. But William Connor Shaw, director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was celebrated as the most honest man in government. Politically naive, of course, but the man dripped integrity. And that wasn't all so bad a quality in a police agency, was it? Congress thought so. There was even talk of eliminating special prosecutors. The FBI had become so clean, especially after the special prosecutor had bungled that. But the Bureau was being segregated from this one. This was an interesting case, wasn't it? A man could win his spurs on something like this. Chapter 17. Processing. The days were shorter now, Jack told himself. It wasn't that he was all that late, just that the days were shortening. The Earth's orbit around the sun, and the way the axis of rotation was not perpendicular with the plane of the ecliptic? Something like that. His driver dropped him off in front of the door, and he walked tiredly in, wondering when the last day had been, outside of the weekends, when he'd seen his house in daylight and not outlined by electric lights. About the only good news was that he didn't bring work home. But that wasn't quite true either, was it? He brought no documents home, but it was less easy to clear out his mind than to clear off his desk. Ryan heard the sounds of a normal house, the TV tuned to Nickelodeon. The washing machine was making noise. Have to have that fixed. He walked into the family room to announce himself. Daddy! Jack Jr. ran over to deliver a hug, followed by a plaintive look. Daddy, you promised to take me to a baseball game. Oh, shit. The kids were back in school, and there couldn't be more than a dozen home games left up in Baltimore. He had to win. When could he break loose? The new communications center project was only half done, and that was his baby, and the contractor was a week behind, and he had to get that back online if it was going to be ready when it was supposed to be. I'm going to try, Jack. Ryan promised his son, who was too young to understand about any obligation beyond a father's promise. Daddy, you promised! I know. Shit! Jack made a mental note. He had to do something about that. Bedtime, Kathy announced. Tomorrow's a school day. Ryan hugged and kissed both of his children, but the exercise in affection merely left an empty spot in his conscience. What sort of a father was he turning into? Jack Jr.'s first communion was next April or May, and who could say if he'd be home for that? Better find out the date so that he could schedule it now. Try to schedule it now. Jack reminded himself that little things like promises to his kids were little things. God, how did this ever happen? Where has my life gone? He watched the kids head to their rooms, then himself headed to the kitchen. His dinner was in the oven. He set the plate on the breakfast counter before walking to the refrigerator. He was buying wine in boxes now. It was much more convenient, and his taste in wine was getting far less selective of late. The cardboard boxes held a Mylar bag full of Australian, wasn't it? About where California wines had been 20 years earlier. The vintage in question was very fruity, to mask its inadequacies, and had the proper alcohol content, which was what he was mainly after anyway. Jack looked at the wall clock. If he were very lucky, he might get 6.5, maybe 7 hours of sleep before a new day started. He needed the wine to sleep.
At the office, he lived on coffee, and his system was becoming saturated with caffeine. Once he'd been able to nap at his desk, but no longer. By 11 in the morning, his system was wired, and by late afternoon, his body played a strange melody of fatigue and alertness that sometimes left him wondering if he were going a little mad. Well, as long as he asked himself that question. A few minutes later, he finished his dinner. Pity the oven had dried it out. Kathy had done this one herself. He'd planned to be home at a decent hour, but it was always something, wasn't it? When he stood, there was a twinge of discomfort from his stomach. On the way into the family room, he opened the closet door to pull a packet of antacid tablets from his coat pocket. These he chewed and washed down with wine, starting off his third glass in less than 30 minutes at home. Kathy wasn't there, though she'd left some papers on the table next to her customary chair. Jack listened and thought he heard a shower running. Fine. He took the cable controller and flipped to CNN for another news fix. The lead story was something about Jerusalem. Ryan settled back into his chair and allowed himself a smile. It was working. The story was about the resurgence of tourism. Shop owners were loading up in anticipation of their biggest Christmas in a decade. Jesus, explained a Jew who'd opted to stay in the town of Bethlehem, was, after all, a nice Jewish boy from a good family. His Arab partner toured the camera crew through the store. Arab partner? Jack thought. Well, why not? It's worth it, Ryan told himself. You helped bring that about. You helped make that happen. You have saved lives. And if nobody else knows, the hell with it. You know. God knows. Isn't that enough? No, Jack told himself in a quiet flash of honesty. So what if the idea had not been completely original? What idea ever was? It had been his thought that had brought it together. His contacts that had gotten the Vatican on board. He deserved something for it. Some recognition. Enough for a little footnote in some history book. But would he get it? Jack snorted into his wine. No chance. Liz Elliott, that clever bitch, telling everybody that it was Charlie Alden who'd done it. If Jack ever tried to set the record straight, he'd look like a swine stealing credit from a dead man. And a good man, despite his mistake with that Bloom girl. Cheer up, Jack. You're still alive. You have a wife. You have kids. It still wasn't fair, was it? Fair? Why had he ever expected life to be fair? Was he turning into another one of them? Ryan asked himself. Another Liz Elliott? Another grasping, small-minded ass with an ego size inversely proportionate to her character? He'd so often worried and wondered about the process, how a person might be corrupted. He'd feared the overt methods, deciding that a cause or a mission was so vital that you might lose perspective on the important things, like the value of a single human life, even the life of an enemy. He hadn't lost that, not ever, and knew that he never would. It was the subtler things that were wearing at him. He was turning into a functionary, worrying about credit and status and influence. He closed his eyes to remind himself of what he already had. A wife, 2 kids, financial independence, accomplishments that no one could ever take away. You are turning into one of them. He'd fought. He had killed to defend his family. Maybe Elliot was offended by that, but in quiet moments like this, Jack remembered the times with a thin, grim smile. Not 200 yards from where he now sat, he'd drilled 3 rounds into a terrorist's chest, coldly and efficiently. Steel on target, validating all the things they'd taught him at Quantico. That his heart had been beating 1,000 times per second, that he'd come close to wetting his pants, that he'd had to swallow back his vomit, were small things. He'd done what he had to do, and because of that, his wife and children were alive. He was a man who'd proven his manhood in every possible way. Winning and marrying a wonderful girl, fathering two God-sent children, defending all of them with skill and courage. Every time fate had presented its challenge, Jack had met it and gotten the job done.
Yeah,
he told himself, smiling at the TV. Screw Liz Elliott. That was a humorous thought. Who, he asked himself, would want to? That cold, skinny bitch with her arrogance and... what else? Ryan's mind paused, seeking the answer to the question. What else? She was weak, wasn't she? Weak and timid. Beneath all the bluster and the hardness, what was really in there? Probably not much. He'd seen that sort of national security advisor before. Cutter, unwilling to face the music. Liz Elliott. Who'd want to screw her? Not very smart, and nothing in there to back up what smarts she did have. Good thing for her that the president had Bunker and Talbot to fall back on. You're better than all of them. It was a satisfying thought to accompany the end of this glass of wine. Why not have another? This stuff really isn't all that bad, is it? When Ryan returned, he saw Kathy was back also, going over her patient notes in the high-back chair she liked. Want a glass of wine, honey? Dr. Carolyn Ryan shook her head. I have two procedures tomorrow. Jack came around to take his place in the other chair, almost not glancing at his wife, but he caught her out the corner of his eye. Wow. Kathy looked up from her paperwork to grin at him. Her face was nicely made up. Jack wondered how she'd managed not to mess her hair up in the shower. Where did you get that?
Out of a catalog.
Whose? Frederick's? Dr. Carolyn Muller Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S., was dressed in a black peignoir that was a masterpiece of revelation and concealment. He couldn't tell what held the robe portion in place. Underneath was something filmy and very nice. The color was odd, though. Kathy's nighties were all white. He'd never forgotten the wonderful white one she'd worn on their wedding night. Not that she'd been a virgin at the time, but somehow that white silk had made her so. That, too, was a memory that would never go away, Jack told himself. She'd never worn it since, saying that, like her wedding dress, it was something to be used only once. What have I done to earn this wonderful girl? Jack asked himself. To what do I owe this honor? Jack asked.
I've been thinking.
About what?
Well, little Jack is 7. Sally is 10. I want another one.
Another what? Jack set his glass down.
Another baby, you dope.
Why? Her husband asked.
Because I can, and because I want one. I'm sorry, she went on with a soft smile,
if that bothers you.
The exercise, I mean.
I think I can handle that.
I have to get up at 4:30, Kathy said next. My first procedure is before 7.
So?
So.
She rose and walked over to her husband. Kathy bent down to kiss him on the cheek.
See me upstairs.
Ryan sat still for a minute or two, gunning down the rest of his drink, switching off the TV, and smiling to himself. He checked to make sure the house was locked and the security system armed. He stopped off in the bathroom to brush his teeth. A surreptitious check of her vanity drawer revealed a thermometer and a little index card with dates and temperatures on it. So, she wasn't kidding. She'd been thinking about this and, typically, keeping it to herself. Well, that was okay, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Jack entered the bedroom and paused to hang up his clothes, donning a bathrobe before joining his wife at the bedside. She rose to wrap her arms around his neck. And he kissed her. You sure about this, babe?
Does it bother you?
Kathy, to please you? Anything you want that I can get or give, honey.
Anything? I wish you'd cut back on the drinking,
Kathy didn't say. It wasn't the time. She felt his hands through the peignoir. Jack had strong but gentle hands that now traced her figure through the outfit. It was cheap and tardy, but every woman was entitled to look cheap and tardy once in a while.